Good morning, I'm Khaki Walton, checking on the arts is made possible by contributing listeners and the Orpheum Theater.
I made a film that I thought was a lot about looking out, and I wanted to make another film that was about looking in. And like my next project is about looking out and in at the same time.
What's this going to be about?
Well, part of it's about you.
But these are the things that children don't need to know about their dad.
It's not a complicated kind of morality. I think he can both consider himself a good person, but sleep with a lot of different women and hurt people in that way. He can be selfish, but he also really loves people.
Dad had his own language, and we were expected to speak it. I loved him so much that I agreed to his syntax, his set of rules.
That's Lynn Sachs narrating her newest film, a film about a father who. That's going to screen outdoors in the lawn at Shelby Farms this Wednesday at 6:30 as part of the 23rd Annual Indie Memphis Film Festival presented by Duncan Williams. It's also available to view virtually on your TV or device from Wednesday, October the 21st through Thursday, October 29th. And Lynn's going to be present for a Q&A at Shelby Farms following the film. A film about a father who is an unflinching portrait of bohemian businessman Ira Sachs Sr. and examines his complex relationship with his children, ultimately asking the question, what is the definition of family? And Lynn Sachs joins me this morning to talk more about the film. We're actually taping this on Sunday afternoon, and she's taken a break from doing something very important to talk to us. Hi, Lynn.
Hello, Khaki. I'm so glad to be here with you in the midst of my canvassing here in North Carolina.
Good for you. Well, thanks for taking a break, and I'm going to let you get back to it shortly, but I'm really excited to talk about this film. We're going to talk about how I'm sure it was emotionally difficult for you to make, but first I thought we could begin by having you describe your father.
Well, growing up with my dad in Memphis was always interesting, and I know people use that word in a kind of flip way, but I really mean it, because he gravitated towards people in Memphis who were doing really extraordinary things. And extraordinary, I say that in a way, not like the power people, but the people who were like Jimmy Cosswaite, who was doing puppeteering, or Bill Eggleston, who was taking his incredible photographs, or Steve Cohen, who was such a fearless, and still is such a fearless Memphis politician who's given so much to the community. So there was this wide range of people, but my dad also lived his own very iconoclastic life. So we had, in a sense, one foot in East Memphis and one foot in downtown or midtown, and that, for a Memphis person, helps to describe a kind of bifurcation or a kind of mix where we wanted to be a part of many different worlds. That, and when I say we, I mean my sister Dana Sachs and Ira Sachs, and we grew up in Memphis. It was so much a part of us. You know, my dad was totally supportive that we wanted to go to the antenna club, but he would also take us to all the, like, the very best rock and roll shows at the auditorium, because he had friends who worked there. And so it was very much a Memphis life, and a way to appreciate the city. But he also broke, like, a lot of the so-called mores or rules that dad sometimes expects. So I was torn between feeling like, whoa, I have this free spirit dad, and whoa, I wish my dad would be like other dads. It was always kind of divided that way.
Well, this is a brutally honest film about him. So you know how people are in the South. They don't tend to air the dirty laundry, quote unquote, so to speak, I guess. So what made you want to take on this project?
Well, it took me about 30 years to make the film, and a lot of things came about after I'd started. So I decided in 91 when I had recently determined, yes, I want to be a filmmaker. This is the life I want to lead. And I said to myself that I wanted to make films in a sort of documentary way, like observing how people live and how cities work and how people struggle. But I also thought that film was a way to look in. Sometimes you shoot from the outside in, and sometimes you shoot your movie from the inside out. So that those two, I felt a commitment to sort of to doing both of those things. And so I decided my dad had left such an imprint on me, but also as a teenager, it was complicated. And I like lots of people say, oh, it's complicated. But, you know, I had to come to terms with my own feminism and with my confusion about his having multiple girlfriends, many of whom sort of stayed the same age while I got older. And that was something to reckon with. But also I thought my dad was interesting. He was very progressive, very involved in the ACLU in Memphis. So it was always a give and take between admiration and forgiveness and rage. And I wanted to see how I could use my, you could say pen, or you could say your paintbrush, or, and in this case, my camera, to explore all of that.
So you mentioned that it's, you've been working on this for over 30 years. I mean, you've made over 35 films, but this one has occupied most of your adult life. How difficult was it exploring your father's challenging issues over such a long period of time?
So, you know, there would be years when I didn't work on the film, partially because it was definitely painful, and other times because it became an obstruction, at least from the perspective of, you know, my family members. First, sometimes they would say, when are you going to finish the dad film? And other times they would say, but you always have your camera out, and that kind of changes the nature of the way that we interact, especially because I started this film in 91, where people most definitely were not carrying cell phones. So people were less self-conscious then. But now people know how media travels. They know how it can be manipulated. And so there was a kind of hesitancy. But eventually I just started doing kind of what you do. I started to record with just audio with all of my siblings in a very quiet place, sometimes even a closet, so that the camera didn't become a mirror at all. You know how when you shoot with the camera, people look at they look at the lens, or they look at you as director, and they want an affirmation. Is this what you want? Is this what you want? And so once I started in 2018 to record all my siblings with just a microphone to sort of go to a deeper place for all of us, I felt like it was a big release. And it was an opportunity for us to become closer, just as siblings, not just in service of this film.
Talk about your narration, because I was reading about the process and how you were writing things down, but then you decided, no, I'm not going to write things down. I'm just going to record my own voice. And it sounded like a really smart way to do it, but also really cathartic. Can you tell people about that?
Yeah, sure. And I'm not surprised that you would ask that as a radio person, as someone who really celebrates the oral in our lives, which I think sometimes is put in the back seat, and with people being so committed to image. So I was at an artist residency actually for a month, and one of my intentions was to write the narration for this film. And I took my notebook and, you know, my Moleskine notebook and my pen, and I thought, I'm just going to sit quietly and look out at the snowstorms and this sort of, you know, kind of typical artist residency experience. But every time I'd write like a page, and then I'd scribble it all out because I thought it wasn't written well, or I thought that I wasn't being eloquent, or I thought that I wasn't being authentic enough. And I was so critical as a reader of the person who had written those words. It's like two different people. So then I said, I need to find a way to be more honest to my feelings and So I got my audio recorder out, and I put my headphones on, and I just started riffing, talking, and exploring ideas. I had pretty much already cut the film, so I knew that I was writing two certain scenes, and I just would kind of follow one tangent after another instead of following a sort of narrative purpose. And then by the end, I had a few hours, and I did that for several days. And then I did the lazy person thing. I put that audio file in an email. I sent it to a transcription service. Lo and behold, 2 days later, I had 20 pages of my voiceover typed out.
Wow.
And then I started to edit that. But it was so much fresher, and it wasn't about, you know, does this, you could tell from the film I'm very interested in grammar and syntax, you know, and kind of like the search for the right word. And instead of searching for the right word on paper, I was searching for something that had, at least to me, the integrity of how I really felt. And I couldn't erase it immediately, and that was critical, because it's so easy I think it's easier to erase on a computer than even on your notebook, because you erase on it in a notebook and you have the, it's like you can still be an archaeologist. You can dig it up. You can extract it. But on a computer, when you write for the first time, you hit delete so quickly, and then it's gone.
Yeah. Well, I loved hearing about how you did that. And I want you to talk, too, about how the film's editor contributed to the process.
That is such a key thing. So I edited the film with Rebecca Schappes. She had been a student of mine at NYU about 6 years ago. I don't teach at NYU right now, but I taught there for 13 years on and off as an adjunct teacher. And she was in a class of mine, and I knew she was a wonderful writer and a very enthusiastic person. And we had reconnected, and I told her I was working on this film, and one of the obstacles, and there were so many, it was like one of the obstacles was that when I watched my footage for this film, either I felt embarrassed, humiliated, or as an artist, I felt like the footage was so ugly. And so I was, again, censoring myself. So I thought, if I have somebody else who doesn't know anyone in my family, and we can look at the footage as like material that landed in our lap. Of course, I was always putting it in context that she could say back to me, oh, we don't need to know that. And she was a whole generation younger than I am. So she was actually not ever judgmental of my dad or any of us. She just watched it as an interesting family that she wanted to explore through this material that had even started before she was ever born. And so she would be sitting at the computer and the keyboard, and I had another, my own laptop, and we just transcribed everything. And then we started to see relationships, and we basically cut 12 what I would call experimental documentary films the first year. And then we started to weave those threads, those 12 films together the second year. And it was liberating to say we didn't need a narrative thread right away, because usually people do that in documentary, like they have a sense of this is the, this is our mission, or this is what we're trying to prove. And once I divided into these sort of film poems, then they took on their own life and their own sort of spirit visual experimentation. We also worked with this composer and sound artist, Stephen Vitiello, who lives in Richmond, Virginia, and we've done 5 films together. So we would send him sounds from the VHS tapes or the Hi-8 tapes or audio recordings, and then he would create music from those sounds. So he was the three of us together, it was really like a dynamic triangle. And actually, we didn't even have to be in the same city, because these days you can do so much from afar.
Well, since we're sort of talking about the technical part of it, technology changed a lot over the course of this project.
It certainly did. And that was another thing that stopped me, because, you know, you become very accustomed to a pristine, high-definition digital image. And so when you look back at something, for example, that I shot in 1984 with my dad on this, I was making my first so-called documentary. I went with him, with my sister Dana. You heard the story in the film. we went to Bali, and I had this VHS camera that was a deck and a camera separate. Back then it worked that way. And then I went back to look at that in 2018 and 19, and I thought it looked, you know, horrible and so kind of imprecise and kind of, you know, faded and like faded jeans. But then when you say faded jeans, people spend a lot of money on faded jeans. And they actually like the distressed look. And then I had this bing moment while Rebecca and I were editing, where we said, oh, to hell with the beautiful image. People can get that on 600 different stations of every, you know, on TV. Let's go for the image that shows its age. It's sort of like, I think a face is more interesting when it has its lines or its wrinkles than when it's covered up with makeup. So we can't put makeup on the old footage. Let's like allow the textures. It's the textures of the moment that was that reality, but also of the technology. And I think that's actually proven to be compelling to people, even if they didn't live in those years. The texture itself speaks of the time. We're all sort of visual anthropologists and archaeologists who can decipher an image based on the surface of it as well as the content.
Well, you know, there was lovely home movie footage of your dad playing with you. And I think, Dana, I don't know if I know the exact order of who came next after you. I don't know if it was Dana or Ira.
It was Dana. Dana's second. I'm 1961. Dana's 1962, and Ira is 1965.
Well, it's the cutest. I mean, you can just tell by look. First of all, I love old home movie footage, and I'm mad because I know my family had some. Who knows where it ended up, because I don't have it. But it's fun looking at that kind of memory from the past. And you can just tell that your dad loved kids.
Yeah. My father he says that the gift he gave to the world was his children. You know, at certain points we thought that was three, then we thought that was six, then we thought that was seven, and then recently we thought it was nine. And we're all really, we're actually quite close now. In fact, today we'll have our regular 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time Zoom meeting with all nine of us.
Aww.
And we've been doing that throughout the quarantine with my dad. And I can't assume this, but I can hope that this film was a catalyst to reconnections, to a kind of, as you said, like a catharsis, an honesty, a reckoning with who our dad, the imprint that our fathers had on us over all these years. I hope that's true.
Well, I can see it bringing all of you closer together and you forming deeper relationships with the other siblings besides Dana and Ira. What did your dad think about being the subject of this film?
You know, I think he really loved it because, for example, I'll tell you something. His fraternity, college fraternity, asked me if they could watch it, and I gave them a link. And then they had this fraternity meeting, and they said, Ira was the wildest guy from our University of Florida 1954 class. but we didn't know all this. So I was a little concerned. I thought they might, you know, judge him, and they could. They could rightfully do that. But instead they said, you know, you showed everything in the story, the life he's led. And a couple of people said, I wish my daughter would do that. And, you know, this is the life that he led. These were choices he made. They weren't accidents. And it comes with plenty of pain, but it also, and I have to say now in 2020, the film doesn't allow us to have a forced amnesia, which was something I was always thinking about. Like if I didn't make this movie, I could have put a lot of these stories to bed. But in other ways, when you get to something that's that is the root of sort of so much of what shaped you as an adult. If you get back to that childhood imprint, and you do it with your siblings, I think you get closer. It just makes your relationships more complicated in a good way. Like, you understand each other as mature people.
Yeah. So do you think that audiences will find something in this that they can relate to?
That has been actually very, very meaningful side of showing the film. I finished it in January and showed it at Slam Dance. Then it was at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And then it's traveled quite a bit virtually, particularly been in the UK. And it's been a big surprise to me how many people have written me, found me through the internet, men and women who have had, it's not the exact story, but they wanted something that would give them permission to go deep into something that maybe they thought it's not so much that they forgot, but they put it in the recesses of their life experiences, and sometimes bringing it out and communicating and working on it it takes you to that next phase of your life as an adult. And so I've had the most incredible conversations with people, and it wasn't so much like about my dad or about my family, but about that process. Even I showed the film in a classroom virtual with 25 documentary students, and they were talking in a way that the professor later told me they'd never talked about the way that film and life can be so interwoven, and that this said to them they didn't have to make movies about things they didn't know anything about, which is kind of like a paradigm in documentary. Oh, you take the exotic and you make it familiar. But maybe in this case, you take the familiar and you expand on it and you investigate it and you come to some other maybe understanding, or like that relationship between art making and life can be more ambiguous rather than strictly divided.
So this interview is going to air on Monday morning, and I think that's a week before your dad's birthday.
Oh, you keep up with a lot of his birthday's on October 26th. So you're exactly right. And my mom's birthday is October 28th. So the later part of October is very special to all of us. And you know, I wanted to add that my mother's been really, really supportive of this film. You know, she understood it was a life she led, and then she moved on. But she's both equally understanding of my need to make the film, and then to see this as a work that reflects a lot about family in general, not just ours.
Right. Well, Lynn Sachs, I know that it wasn't the easiest process to go through, but you were compelled to do it, and I'm glad that you made a film about a father who, again, that's going to premiere at the Indie Memphis Film Festival with a lawn screening at Shelby Farms Wednesday, October 21st, so this coming Wednesday at 6:30. Lynn will be there for a Q&A following the film, and you can also watch it virtually on your TV or device. That's going to be available Wednesday, October 21st from 6:30 all the way through October the 29th of next week. So go to IndieMemphis.org to get your tickets to a film about a father who. Check the website to see the rest of the festival schedules. Find out ways you can fest, whether it's attending a lawn screening, going to the drive-in, or having a virtual experience. I want to thank filmmaker Lynn Sachs for being my guest this morning. Lynn, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much.